Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Adisk, and James Corbett of The Corbett Report will be joining you for the second and third segment of the program today. And today is Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. Once again, thank you for joining us, and not to confuse you, it is Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. I first want to give out the special before we get into the market report, because usually these 20 minutes go by so quick, and I fail to get the special in, and so it is a simple special today, 90% silver quarters, and I also have some dimes coming in, 90% quarters, $1,400. For $100 face value, $100 face value of 90% quarters, and I do have some dimes also arriving here shortly. Did some online comparison shopping, and one of the competitors online, a big company by the looks of their website anyway, they're about 80 cents more per ounce for their 90% quarters in the same condition, which equals, if you were buying a full bag, about $580 more. So make sure you give us a call at 1-800-375-4188, 90% quarters and dimes, $1,400, $100 face value. And make sure you visit the website, dgscoins.com, and make sure you sign up for our weekly newsletter, and of course the radio program can be listened there live and archived. So now we will go to the precious metals. Gold today struggled, currently down 80 cents a buck at 1166.90. Silver, it's weird. Silver moved, it stayed, didn't budge, up $15.93. Platinum was up 5 at 1014. Palladium was up 9 at 689. U.S. dollar was strong as could be, which amazes me that gold did as well as it did today. The USDX, 1.30 to the upside, 96.36. Crude oil up 0.27, and there is a reason why that dollar is up 1.30. I'm going to try to get to that here real quick. Crude oil was up 27.27 to 45.47. And the paper markets today, of course, loved whatever news they attached themselves to that made everybody feel fairly confident today. The Dow was up 320 at 17,489. NASDAQ up 79. 49.20, S&P up 33 at 2,052, and I'll tell you why the dollar drops significantly, the euro down 2.02. That's a huge drop in the euro, 1.111. Yesterday it was 1.13. Why? Well, the central bank came out, and the European Central Bank is worried about China and the developing markets, and the European Central Bank signaled it would increase monetary stimulus to the eurozone at a meeting in December, and with that announcement, of course, the euro tanked. The remarks by Mario Draghi raised expectations that the bank might extend. It's 1.1 trillion euro, but that is $1.2 trillion bond purchase program aimed at raising inflation and helping a spotty recovery. He made it clear that the ECB was also considering other measures, such as further cutting one of its key interest rates if they need to act, and they are ready to act if needed. And I can remember Ben Bernanke saying the same thing through all of the points and times during their little meetings, and the stimulus was buying up all those bond purchases and so forth. They were ready to act if needed. And of course, the European Central Bank is using the same playbook as the Ben Bernanke did of the Federal Reserve. So he made it clear. And of course, the euro fell sharply. And as they see monetary stimulus or lower rates, will have a tendency to weigh on a currency. And so they're going to try to hold out, again, it's to provide confidence. They need inflation. They'll work on getting inflation. They're looking to cut, again, as I mentioned, the benchmark interest rate to a record low of 0.05. And they could also... They discussed this, but perhaps they would further cut in the deposit rate charged to banks to leave excess cash at the central bank. If they lower it a little bit more, perhaps it would push these banks into not hoarding money, but maybe invest it, or, maybe do what they're supposed to do is lend it out. What's interesting I find about this announcement and the huge drop in the euro and the huge gain in the dollar is, and it depends if you believe in coincidences. Yesterday we talked about an announcement that Britain will be China's partner of choice in the West. And adding additional stimulus to keep their currency weak against the dollar, it benefits everyone. It benefits all countries except the U.S. While every nation on earth is doing everything at their disposal to lower the value of their currency for trade, the U.S. has no power to reverse the effect. Or they would have done so already. Or perhaps this is their... You know these countries and nations make all these agreements. So maybe did Britain, in exchange for the services of China in building their new nuclear power plant, agree to support a weaker euro to keep both the Chinese currencies and the euro, the European currency, low and the dollar strong? I don't believe in coincidences, and when you see relationships that are being created and warmed, you have China and Britain, these are strong words when they say that they're the new Western partnership, that the U.S. is no longer relevant, is how I viewed that. So that certainly put pressure on the euro, and the dollar gained strength. Why is the Dow up over 300 points? The only reason I can relate to is the, I believe it was the announcement of the speaker, Paul Ryan, I believe accepted. And I would think that would have provided a little bit of confidence mainly into the debt ceiling situation that is quickly approaching. And perhaps the markets felt that with Ryan in there, and, you know, he certainly has gone in there stating, you know, he needs the support of everyone. We know him and Obama seem to be getting along quite well and so forth, that the markets felt good, thinking this problem will be solved. And it was a confidence run because there really wasn't anything else in the news to really support anything. There was a couple of good earnings out of McDonald's and so forth, but I can't believe that would move the markets as strong as it did. That was the only other announcement that I saw today. And it's interesting because when you look at some of these numbers, you know, when the debt ceiling, you know, there's discussions that it can be November 3rd, you hear November 10th, November 19th, Lou moved it to the 3rd. So, you know, Congress has another week or so to raise the debt ceiling. And if they do end up defaulting on any of its obligations, I saw a breakdown and I thought it was interesting and I thought I would share it with you. Every month, the Treasury pays 100 million bills, 100 million bills. This is what they pay. Most of them are automated. And they do, rob Peter to pay Paul. And between the dates of November 10th and 30th, there would be $218 billion. That's how much the government would owe, $218 billion. And how much do we have coming in? About $147 billion. So they would have to decide what gets paid and what doesn't get paid. What would get paid, of course, are the bondholders. And that comes to about $30 billion. You have Medicare and Medicaid, about $45 billion. Social Security, about $42 billion. Active and retired military, $3 billion. Defense contractors, $17 billion. Food stamps, unemployment, temporary assistance for needy families, and housing programs, about $12 billion. I see a few of those in there that they could cut, you know, and I wanted to talk about unemployment today, but perhaps tomorrow. The delay of $71 billion in payments, you know, maybe the IRS tax refunds, oh, you know, that'd be the first one they wouldn't pay. Education programs, well, we could chalk that one off. That would be a good one to cut anyway. Federal salaries and benefits, $12 billion. Human and health services grants, that should immediately be cut. I mean, we shouldn't pay, you know, anyway. Payments to assorted agencies. There's not a breakdown on the assorted agencies, the Federal Highway Administration for Road Construction, Federal Aviation, FEMA, and the National Flood Insurance Program. So those are the ones that would be cut, or they would have to wait a little bit longer in order to get paid. So I just thought that was interesting. I wanted to share that with you. And so I think with the announcement of Paul Ryan, I think this is why we saw that this would no longer be a problem. And they would, So anyway, I'm going to move on since that was discussed long enough, and I really wanted to get to this a little bit, and we're already 15 minutes into the program, and I just wanted to, you know, Hillary Clinton today testified before the House Benghazi Select Committee that killed four Americans, and I watched a little bit of it, not much, but I watched a little bit of it, and the arrogance that you saw coming from that woman was just incredible. I mean, she's smiling and laughing. You know, when she got a little bit of support from the various Democrats, you know, she'd smile and joke. I'm like, this is a big joke to her. And, of course, you know, then there's those who believe that this is all about her, you know, her campaign, her run for president, that she, you know, she's being a target. This is a way to discredit her. And I just don't understand how people think that this would be the only, I mean, there should be a bottom to this. There should have, these exchanges should have gone on 2 years ago, not today. It's been a long, drug out situation. And, but today I saw a little bit of Republican Ohio Representative Jim Jordan. He took some issues with her comments and protests while she was that had erupted in both Cairo, Egypt, and Benghazi, Libya. And again, this isn't my expertise, but this is to show what kind of woman that people might have the opportunity to vote for in the next election. And they really do need to find out a little bit more about her and not to vote her just because I like her. She's Hillary Clinton and she's a woman. I think we got that problem with Obama. People voted for him just because he was black. And so we don't need to vote for Hillary just because she's a female. And he was asking, and he was quoting from various State Department spokespersons who he was quoting, who in the weeks following the September 11, 2012 attack claimed that the incident in Benghazi was linked to the Cairo-based protest, which was a reaction to an offensive online video. And he says, where'd the false narrative start? It started with you, Madam Secretary, he said, adding that a statement released by Clinton that night of the attack suggests as much. And he goes on and describes the various times of these, what was happening during these attacks. And he couldn't just let the discrepancy go. He says, citing additional emails and calls made to the Libyan president, the Egyptian prime minister, and her own family. In all three messages, Clinton said that the State Department knew that the attack in Libya had nothing to do with the film. It was a planned attack, not a protest. When Clinton again references her statement's language, Jordan erupted, calling an attack is like saying the sky is blue, and he goes on and goes on. And what I want to bring this to the bottom is he talks, he presses on. He's repeating his previous comments and criticizing Clinton's attempted answers to them, and they bantered back and forth for a few minutes. But then when the congressman had to wrap it up, he reiterated his main line of argument. Her response was she plugged her book. When Chairman Trey Gowdy had asked Clinton whether or not she wanted to respond, she plugged her book. She says, I wrote a whole chapter about this in my book, Hard Choices. I'd be glad to send it to you, Congressman. And it's just like, I just can't believe these people get away with what they do. And the arrogance that, again, that I saw, the smiles, the jokes, like this is a joke. There's so much about Hillary Clinton that most people of today don't know about. They weren't around in the 90s when she was being exposed for all the baggage that she carries. Most people can relate to her as far as Benghazi. You know, most people don't know that she failed her D.C. bar exam and only came to the Arkansas bar after Bill intervened. She did not work on legal services for the poor. She was an aide to a communist that was head of the California Communist Party and a lawyer for the Black Panther trial in New Haven, Connecticut. And she took her law internship with him. She wasn't able to secure employment in Arkansas, but got hired by the Arkansas Law School because Bill was employed there. Bill probably did more for her career than anyone. She did not gain employment at the Rose Law Firm until after Bill was Arkansas Attorney General. And what did she do as Secretary of State? She didn't do anything. Look at the mess in the Middle East. Very few people remember Vince Foster, who was murdered in 1973, claimed it was a suicide. But after he shot himself in the head, he threw his gun over a berm behind him. And he was Hillary's attorney. Yesterday, I mentioned the Whitewater scandal. They were Bill Clinton, then president, was accused of being complicit in a series of legal loans provided to the Whitewater Corporation. Clinton herself was suspected of creating false documents to conceal an illegal $300,000 loan to a doomed corporation. I mean, the list just goes on, and people don't want to know this. They need to know it. The history of Hillary needs to come out, and you just can't vote for Hillary because it's Hillary and you like her. And I believe we are out of time. So I want to thank you for joining us. Make sure you get a special 90% silver quarters and dimes, $1,400. Stay tuned. Alfred and James Corbett will be here with you in just a few short minutes.
Is afraid of pain. No one wants pain to rule over their life, and you don't want the negative side effects of aspirin, ibuprofen, or prescription drugs. They can lower immunity and cause dependency. Is there a safe alternative? I'm herbalist Wendy Wilson, and I prefer willow bark and meadow sweet herbs to control pain, fever, aches, and inflammation. God's herbs are good, and you won't be disappointed. Call Apothecary Herbs for pain or extra strength pain relief formula. Toll free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International, 704-875-8010 or online, thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest is scheduled to be James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. James is he's a growing voice that has, this herd around the country. Around, not just around the country, around the world. He's having an impact. He's growing and becoming more significant. He does have a problem, which is apparently his computer is messed up. And according to our producer, James is rebooting that computer at this moment, at this time, and there may be a delay before he actually joins. Oh, here he is.
James,
how you doing?
I'm doing all right. I don't know about my computer, but it seems to be working at the moment.
All right. I've just introduced you and gave you a number of compliments and the rest of it, and you're going to have to trust me that I've already complimented you, and we'll just go on from here. Were you willing to trust me in that matter? Apparently, we're going to be rebooting again. James is not speaking to me right now, so I'm going to have to go on. We'll talk. We'll see how soon it is before James is able to make the connection. Here's an article from Simon Black at SovereignMan.com. And the headline is Bankrupt U.S. Government. The government's own numbers show that official liabilities, including the debts held by public and federal retirement benefits, total $20.7 trillion. Yet the government's assets, including the value of the entire federal highway system, the national parks, cash balance, etc., totals just over $3 trillion. The official liabilities are $20 trillion. They claim it's $18 trillion for the moment. But he says the numbers show that the official liabilities are $20 trillion at the moment, and in fact, they're much. According to John Williams, they run in terms of $100 trillion right now. According to the Congressional Budget Office, as of a couple of years ago, and more recently, economist Lawrence Kotlikoff, the real national debt, including unfunded liabilities, is over $200 trillion. But we're going to run with the numbers we have here. Government's assets are officially, liabilities are officially $20.7 trillion. Government's total assets are $3 trillion. $3 trillion. Then total, the government's net worth is a negative $17.7 trillion, a level that completely dwarfs the housing crisis. If you include the government's own estimates of the Social Security shortfall, this number declines to a negative $60 trillion. And it gets worse every year. If you conduct a present value calculation of the future tax revenue of the U.S. government, discounted by the official 2% rate of inflation, the U.S. government's ability to tax its citizens is worth $150 trillion. So, this is confusing a little bit. I'm sure it is. On the one hand, they're saying total negative debt is $60 trillion, but others calculate it's actually at least $100 trillion and probably more than $200 trillion. But nevertheless, run with the $60 trillion. Government can calculate that it has $150 trillion in assets. Based on what it will be able to tax citizens for some time into the future. But the article goes on, it says, but if you're going to count the government's tax authority as an asset, you have to be intellectually honest and consider the expenses as liabilities. Think about it. Yes, the government brings in tax revenue every single year, but for nearly every year over the past 70 years, they've spent far more money to deliver on the promises they've made to the citizens. This is deficit spending. What they're simply saying is governments, we can calculate that our ability to tax the citizens is $150 trillion. Okay, all right, we'll go along with that. But if we look back at the last 70 years, every year, however much they brought in, they've spent more paying out. Which implies that if they can calculate that the net worth of the government's taxing capacity, if that's worth another $150 on the books, on the ledger, the accounting balance here for the government, how deep it's in debt and so on, they can calculate it's worth $150 trillion. but they also have to calculate the expenses. And for the last 70 years, they've spent more than they've taken in, which means that over whatever period of time they're calculating that they could bring in $150 trillion in tax revenue, during that same period of time, they're going to probably pay out $170 trillion, maybe $200 trillion, in expenses and entitlements and whatever. Which means the government is bankrupt. All right, what we've really the promises are liabilities. Those promises, the entitlements, the promises for pension funds, the promises for you pay us taxes now, we're going to have Social Security for you later. All of those promises are liabilities. And given the government's spending history since the end of World War II, the liabilities far exceed the tax authority asset. More important, though, isn't it a little bit scary to consider that the government's number one asset is its ability to steal money from taxpayers? Or that the only way the government can make its liabilities go away is by defaulting on the promises it has made to its citizens? So there's only two choices for government. All right? They can either steal from you by raising taxes or default on you by refusing to provide the benefits that you've come to expect, pensions in particular, but entitlements, welfare, unemployment. The ultimate point on this is that the government is technically bankrupt, and not barely bankrupt, bankrupt a lot. If we ignore the argument about $150 trillion in taxing authority over the course of the next however many years, don't even get into that. We're still sitting here where government admits that it has $20 trillion in liabilities, and it has just over $3 trillion in assets. Government is technically bankrupt. All right? And we still have not, James has not returned, and I'm not sure how long we're going to wait on this, but apparently he's having a problem with his computer, and it may be that before we get done, maybe he won't even be here this evening, he is rebooting his whole computer. Well, that's what Frank says, he's rebooting his whole computer. I don't know what he tried to reboot in the past. I think that's the only way you can do it is reboot the whole thing. I don't think you can reboot a part at a time, but who knows, maybe you can. What else have we got? Skype be fire. What does that mean? The producer is sending me coded messages, apparently. Before. Oh, Skype before, not be fire. Okay. I thought he was sending me coded messages to make sure that that NSA or the CIA or whoever didn't intercept our message and find out what we were talking about. He rebooted Skype before. All right, now he's rebooting the whole computer, and we may get to where we reboot all of Japan before the program is over. Let's see what we've got to talk about in the meantime. Here's one. This is from Agence France-Presse, the French news outlet. Headline is Gulf should adjust to new oil price reality. This is from the International Monetary Fund. Gulf economies need to adjust to the new reality of oil prices expected to remain low for some time, according to the International Monetary Fund. They are therefore recommending spending cuts and income diversification for the nations in the Middle East who are dependent, whose primary source of income is the sale of crude oil. It goes on and says, but the oil-rich monarchies remain in a strong position to make the necessary adjustments thanks to large financial reserves they've built up during the years of firmer prices. This is according to the International Monetary Fund Regional Outlook, republished on Wednesday. All right. If the nations of the Middle East, the oil-producing nations, if they have large financial reserves, what do you suppose those reserves are composed of? Given that Saudi Arabia and OPEC agreed 40 years ago to sell their crude oil only for U.S. dollars. I'm going to assume that most of those large financial reserves built up when prices were higher are denominated in crude, are denominated in U.S. dollars. If so, that means that some significant sum of U.S. dollars are about to come out of the oil producers' vaults and be spent into the global economy. Those newly released dollars that have previously been saved off in a hidey hole, they're going to come out into the economy, and when they do, they should contribute to some degree of inflation. I don't know how much inflation they might cause, but we have to assume there's going to be hundreds of billions of U.S. dollars added to the global economy coming out of the Middle East, perhaps each year for the next several years, and we'll support that a little more as we get on. This article continues. It says, not only this year, but for the years to come, these countries will need to make an adjustment to better balance their spending to the new reality of oil prices. This is from the IMF. Now, the IMF says the prices, they are a new reality. They were $115 18 months, 2 years ago, $115 a barrel. They're now $45 a barrel. That's probably a 60%, maybe more than 60% decline in prices in the last 18 months or so. The IMF is saying this is not an aberration. This is not something that, well, it's just a downstroke and they'll come back up, you know, just another couple months, couple weeks, whatever, and the price of oil will be going back up. The IMF is saying no, it's down and it's not an accident. The price of oil, crude oil, is down, and it's going to stay down, and they're saying for years to come. Insofar as the IMF and others claim that oil prices will remain low for the next several years, they imply that they don't expect the world economy to pick up steam anytime soon. Of course, one reason for oil prices or low oil prices in the future may be the additional supply provided by Iran. Iran's been out of the market for 20 years or thereabouts, maybe more, I'm not sure how long. The boycott on Iran has restricted their ability to sell crude oil into the international market. But now that they're playing nice with the United States, they're going to be pumping more crude oil out into the world market. And the additional Iranian oil is going to increase the supply of crude oil if it's available. And that will probably contribute to a declining price. But even so, the stronger implication is that the International Monetary Fund and others believe the global economy will remain in a recession or even a depression for several years. And during that time, global demand for crude oil will be so low that the price will remain low and may even fall further. Right? If the economy is not running hot and fast, we aren't going to need much energy. If we don't need much energy, then we don't need much crude oil, which means the price is going to fall. The IMF report says oil exporters in the Middle East and North Africa will lose around $360 billion in oil revenues this year. This implies that the Middle East is going to spend, we don't know that they'll spend the full, the price has fallen so much that they're going to lose $360 billion in revenue this year. That doesn't necessarily mean that they'll dig into the bank vaults and pull out $360 billion in U.S. currency that's previously been, you know, kept in the hidey hole and on the sidelines and not really going into the economy. But there's a good chance that they're going to pull $360 billion out of the bank vaults and hidey holes and inject that into the global economy. They'll inject it by first spending it domestically to try to compensate for the lack of crude oil sales and so on. They'll spend it in their own economies. They'll do what they have to do. But as the Middle East has less revenue, it should also have more poverty. No matter what they're doing here, if there's a loss of $360 billion in oil revenues, if they don't pull all of that back up, out of their vaults, out of the hidey holes, and spend it to support their economy and make up for the loss of crude oil sales. They're going to be more hungry people in the Middle East. If there's more poverty, price of oil's down, Middle East depends on crude oil to support the nations and even the people there. As the price falls, there's going to be more poverty, which should be conducive to greater instability and even revolutions in the region. And the implication is that with the falling price of crude in the Middle East, we just might trigger another Arab Spring. Last time we had that, a number of governments were overthrown. A number were threatened with overthrow. We might see another Arab Spring. And the real point to all of this is that we're going to see more instability, more political instability, and potentially more violence and chaos in the Middle East as long as the price of crude oil stays down. And that'll probably stay down as long as the economy remains, global economy remains in recession or perhaps even depression. We're going to take a break now for a couple more commercials. When we return, James will be here. He's apparently got that computer up and functioning. James Corbett will join us shortly. Please stay tuned. I'm Alfred Addis, and we'll be right back.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad spectrum immune boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll free 866-229-3663 or online thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663 or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival, and our guest is James Corbett. James is calling in from Japan. Had a little computer problems at his end, and so we're only now getting him on the program for the last 15 minutes or so. James is here virtually every Thursday night and always offers some fine insight into what's happening in geopolitics and the global economy, U.S. economy, Chinese economy, and becoming something of a recognized expert. You're kind of cracking that barrier where people are paying attention to you on a global basis, James. Is that, do you agree with that? Is that an accurate assessment?
I couldn't claim to say who or in what way I'm being held or in what regard, but I can say that I do have listeners all around the globe that I'm in touch with every day, and I do appreciate all the people who help to spread this information, because it really is the people out there who are spreading this work that make it really what it is, I think, more so than the way that people esteem or fail to esteem my own regard.
Well, you know, I mean, you can be modest about that and the rest of that, but the truth of the matter is that you have a gift for articulating what's happening in a way that people can understand. And I have no idea how you're keeping on top of as many things as you are. It seems like you must be working about 36 hours a day in order to stay current with everything that's going on around the globe. So you're doing a remarkable job, and I think it's being more and more appreciated. Another months, years, I think you're going to have a much more significant reputation. But let's get on with an article here from The Street that's interesting. And the headline is, "The New Game of Geopolitics and Economics Requires the U.S. and the Federal Reserve to Change." And the article says, in part, for the past 25 years, America has utterly dominated great power politics. Increasingly, however, it lives in a contested world. They go on, they say, don't count the U.S. out, however. The Economist writes that America remains the only country able to project power right across the entire globe. They add that in terms of economics and finance, its sway, America's sway, over the financial system is still growing. Now, that surprises me. I might be able to believe that the American sway over the global financial system is holding its own. I might be able to believe that. I'm inclined to think it's diminishing. But they say it's still growing. What do you say?
I think I do agree with that, and I think that may be less because of any growing importance for the status of the average American worker so much as the sort of erosion of economies around the world, as well as the relative increase of the multinational conglomerates who are headquartered in the U.S. So I guess if you count that as the American economy, then yes, I mean, Apple and some of these companies are doing quite well. I don't think that really necessarily means anything to the average American per se, but it certainly is, I guess, an American phenomenon in quotation marks. But I find the idea of the new game, as this Street.com article is talking about, referencing an Economist article titled "The New Game," I think that's an interesting phrase to be using, because I hope people who followed my work, and hopefully other people as well, will know about the Great Game, which was a contest really over India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that region, and of course Central Asia as well, as one of the dominoes in that region, between the UK and Russia, way back in the 19th century. And we've heard the phrase coming back into play in terms of the new Great Game, which is supposedly being played again in Central Asia, this time more so between the NATO powers and China and Russia, and those seem to be the forces that are lining up there. And I think that is an interesting way of encapsulating not only the new Great Game geopolitically in Central Asia, but I think just generally speaking, this is the way the sort of economic game is lining up as well. I think it is. Obviously, we're being positioned into believing it's a sort of BRICS versus the IMF World Bank, and I think that encapsulates that sentiment that America, quote-unquote, is holding sway and even greater sway. And I think there's at least two ways we should look at that. One is militarily. I think there's no question there. There's a lot of talk about the rise of the Chinese military, and of course it is modernizing and becoming, I suppose, more of a threat. But still, when compared to the United States military, it really does not even hold a candle. The only military in the planet that really even comes close to perhaps holding a candle to the United States is Russia, because of their obviously their Soviet modernization and then everything that took place there and their nuclear arsenal. But really, militarily, there's no question the only power that's capable of projecting military might anywhere in the globe at any moment's notice is the United States. And economically speaking, as I say, I think there's a dual phenomenon. There's the emerging market economies, which have been doing well for the past decade and a half or so, but largely on the basis of dollars flowing out of the U.S. and into the emerging markets as investments. But that, of course, is threatening to unwind as the dollar gains and as rates perhaps won't they hike later this year. That unwind would draw that money out of the emerging markets and, of course, raise the relative status of the United States. So I think there's a few ways to look at it, but yes, I do believe the United States still is the unquestionable world superpower, and is, in a relative sense, I think perhaps even taking a greater share of global economic economic pie.
Now, that's a surprise to me because we hear so much about China. I know China's had a problem in the last year and whatever, and China may be on the skids. I get that. Maybe, maybe not. I don't understand. I can't say for sure, but when you see the problems that are here in the United States and the problems we have with our economy, and yet we're left to wonder if we are gaining power over the world's financial system, that surprises me. I mean, we have the yuan, we have agreements between Russia and China to move crude oil from Russia to China without the intervention of the dollar. We seem to hear constantly that the dollar's in trouble, the economy's in trouble, the U.S. is in trouble, and yet here we have an article that says maybe, all things considered, we're doing better than a lot of people suspect. Surprises me. What else have we got? Here's another one from the street, and the headline is, Why the Federal Reserve Has Almost Become the World's Central Bank. The Federal Reserve may not be the central bank of the world, but it sure produces results like it is from time to time. It seems like everything the Fed does for the U.S. gets blown up in the rest of the world, even when it doesn't intend to function as the central bank of the world. It can really change things in other countries, and they talk about Brazil. They go on and they illustrate this argument with Brazil. But do you think that the central bank... Do you think it's a fair description to say they are on the verge of becoming central bank for the world? Is that a fair description or is that just hyperbole?
Well, there's a sense in which that's true, and I think that's related to exactly what we were talking about before, which is the fact that so much of the world global growth over the past decade and a half has obviously rested on the manufacturing base of China, which has accounted for China's rise, economically speaking. But really, I mean, the global trade is being conducted primarily by and primarily in American dollars. I mean, it's still the U.S. dollar is still the global trade currency for the most part. And I think the most interesting threat to that, as you referenced earlier, is the rise of the petro-yuan, as it's being called, i.e. the settlement of Russian-Chinese oil and gas deals, for example, in local currencies, in the renminbi and the ruble. I mean, that's a real threat to the U.S. petrodollar system, and I think one that I think will have greater prominence as the century progresses. But at this point, I'd still say yes. I mean, the Federal Reserve, again, because of their ability to set interest rates, which affect the flow of, which affect the availability of easy U.S. credit in the U.S. dollar denominated credit in the U.S. banking system, really it has been dictating the flow of those funds into more lucrative emerging market economies over the past decade and a half. And as I say, if the Fed raises rates, the immediate effect, the first primary effect of that will be for those dollars to flood back into the U.S., drawing out of the emerging markets. So like we saw with the rupee crisis in India a couple of years ago when the Fed started talking about putting the brakes on QE, or as we're seeing right now in Brazil with just incredible inflation and just some real economic turmoil going on in Brazil that's turning into political turmoil, I think, again, it relates directly back to the Federal Reserve and the decisions it's making with its rates. And Zero Hedge had an interesting article on this with an interesting take, I think just a day or two ago, talking about the way that you could view the Federal Reserve's use of the rate hike or failure to hike rates as a type of weapon that can be wielded against other economies. And I think the Federal Reserve understands that, and tacitly, I think Janet Yellen admitted that in the last FOMC meeting when she came out and said it was because of kind of global instability is one of the reasons, one of the factors they're taking into account when they're deciding not to hike rates right now. Of course, the other side of that is if we hike rates, you know, your economy is going in the tank, and we know it. It is a type of weapon that can be used economically. And so I think the Federal Reserve in that sense does have a dagger that they are hanging over everyone's head, and they understand that at this point. So to that extent, yes, you could say certainly the Federal Reserve's decisions have a worldwide effect. And whether you want to quibble whether that means they are the world's central bank or not, I guess that's more semantics.
Do you think they want to be the world's central bank? Do they want that power? They know they have it, but do they want it? Do they want more of it? Or are they actually, would they prefer just to say, look, we got enough problems just running the United States economy, we'll let the rest of this go? Do they want these global consequences, or...
The people who really control the decisions of the Federal Reserve certainly do want that power, I would say. I don't know about the individual, you know, board members of the Federal Reserve Board or what have you, but certainly I'd say just systemically, it is obviously the position that anyone who's interested in power and money and being able to control the flow of money wants to have that power extended. That's the nature of people in positions of power and the nature of systems like these that try to become that system where, you know, you say the word, you flip a switch, and the economy changes on a dime. Of course, that's the dream of all would-be dictators and people who want to control the system. Now, again, whether individual board members on the Federal Reserve Board have that in mind, I don't know. But I think the encapsulation of this really isn't in the Federal Reserve itself. It's in the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, where all of these central bankers get together and exchange ideas, quote unquote, about how to really to function globally on global scale with these central bank decisions, and they do things like harmonize their strategies and decisions and try to create some sort of balance in the central bank world system. I think that in and of itself is the step towards what is the ultimate creation of some sort of world central bank, and I think that's where we can see that kind of power and avarice for power being manifested. So yes, I mean, I think there are people at those levels of decision making that certainly do desire and covet that type of influence over the world economy.
Here's an article from, where is it from? I can't even read it. FP, I'm not sure. In any case, how Putin's Ukrainian dream turned into a nightmare. Whatever the larger goal of Russian President Vladimir Putin's armed intervention in Syria, it has succeeded in distracting the world's attention from his ongoing aggression in eastern Ukraine. In his half-hour speech at the United Nations earlier this month, timed to reach a primetime Russian audience, he spent only a minute on the Ukrainian conflict, focusing instead on Russia's constructive role in the Middle East. Putin's rhetorical redirection is not surprising. The Kremlin's war in the Ukraine is turning into a quagmire. Militarily, it's a stalemate. And the headline says, this has turned, Putin's Ukrainian dream has turned into a nightmare. Do you agree with that assessment?
On one level, yes, I think that's exactly right. And on the other level, it's 100% wrong. And I guess what I mean by that is that I think the situation in Ukraine is a quagmire right now, and it has settled into, I mean, I don't want to say settled, there's still ongoing developments, but it has certainly not, there has not been any major progress in on either side of that conflict in recent months. And to that extent, yes, it is a quagmire, and it is something that I think, yes, maybe Putin does want to distract from, but to frame it as if this is Putin's war and Putin's aggression and it's Putin's dream to take over Ukraine or something of that sort, I think obviously frames it in a propagandistic way that neglects the actual history of the conflict and how it unfolded, where, of course, it wasn't initiated by Putin. It was supposedly the sort of spontaneous uprising of the Ukrainian people throwing out their president, who clearly was a crony and not a nice person. But this supposedly spontaneous uprising that interestingly featured snipers who shot both at the protesters and at the police. And no one's ever explained that, of course, precipitated the violence that became the overthrow, that became the insurrection, that became the civil war, that became whatever is happening right now. So, again, to think that this is all just some sort of Putin plan, it's ridiculous. It would be as ridiculous as suggesting that Russia doesn't have military presence and influence on what's happening in eastern Ukraine. Of course they do. But the question is, where is the aggression coming from? Who initiated it and to what end? And I don't think it's at all so clear-cut that this is Putin's dream.
I agree with you. And we are out of time, James. I really wish we had another segment. I need another 20 minutes for my fix, but I guess I'm going to have to wait until next Thursday. Look forward to talking to you again next Thursday. This is James Corbett from TheCorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. I'm Alfred Addis, because Financial Survival will be back tomorrow with Melody. Thanks for listening, folks. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. There never seems to be a single penny left for me.